I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is demanding answers from Blackwater USA today, the huge private security firm whose guards are accused of opening fire on Iraqi civilians last month. Democrats called the company aggressive and reckless. Republicans said it was irresponsible for the House Congressional Oversight Committee to even hold a hearing when investigations are underway. A new congressional report paints a picture of Blackwater as a rogue private force. The founder of Blackwater, former Navy SEAL Eric Prince, defended his company, saying that 30 of his contractors died while protecting U.S. diplomats. Well, for more on today's hearings, we go to Evan Perez of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Evan.
Hi, very well.
And we want to just give some background on Blackwater. It was the company that Prince founded in 1997. 10 years later, it's received $1 billion in contracts from the U.S. government. And Committee Chair Henry Waxman seemed to set the tone of at least his point of view of the hearing by saying that, you know, by opening and saying that this has been very good for Blackwater, but how good has this been for the American taxpayer?
Right, that's the point of this of the hearing today, essentially sort of shining a light on the question of whether or not using private contractors is really that good for the war effort. The question is, you know, is it better to perhaps just use the U.S. military on some of these jobs instead of paying contractors who, you know, if you compare the numbers, at least the way the committee has arranged them, it does look like the U.S. military could do this for a lot less money.
Well, Blackwater bills the U.S. government over $1,000 a day for a single protective security specialist, according to the congressional report. That works out to $500,000 on an annual basis. That's far higher than the military, again, according to the congressional report. But then there's also the question of skill. Waxman questioned the head of Blackwater, Eric Prince, about whether Blackwater pilots were careless in an event that took place in Afghanistan, where these the helicopter ended up crashing into a canyon wall, killing three. It was an airplane, and it killed three military personnel when it crashed. Waxman asked Eric Prince what changes the company made after that incident.
Anytime there's an accident, a company always should be introspective and look back and see what can be done to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Well, aside from your introspection, were you ever penalized in any way? Were you ever fined or suspended or reprimanded or placed on probation?
I believe the Air Force investigated the incident and they found that it was pilot error. It was not due to corporate error.
Evan, Waxman really elaborated on this. He read transcripts from the flight where the pilots seemed to be, you know, reckless, having fun and deviating from their route. It was pretty, you know, condemning moment.
Right, and the company, I mean, as it has done, it has taken this very aggressive legal strategy here in the U.S. As you know, there are a number of lawsuits related to several of these incidents in Iraq, and even with regard to the investigation of the Afghanistan incident you're just talking about, the company has been very aggressive in basically staking out a position that it didn't have any fault, and so it's fighting the, for example, the investigation by the NTSB. It is questioning the outcome of that investigation, and it has been very aggressive in courts as well.
Well, and we're going to talk in a moment about the legal questions that are raised by the work of private contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan. But to some of the other incidents brought up in the report and addressed at the hearings, the report accuses the State Department of a lack of oversight. In one instance, even enabling Blackwater to get a contractor out of the country after he allegedly killed an Iraqi bodyguard in a drunken stupor. Democrat Carolyn Maloney of New York asked Eric Prince about this. Prince didn't deny that the contractor had done something wrong, but she questioned Prince about why the contractor didn't face criminal charges.
Look, I'm not going to make any apologies for what he did.
Okay,
he clearly violated our policies.
All right, every American believes he violated policies. If he lived in America, he would have been arrested, and he would be facing criminal charges. If he was a member of our military, he would be under a court-martial. But it appears to me that Blackwater has special rules.
Evan, these questions were directed to the head of Blackwater. But was he proxy, in fact, for State Department and Pentagon policy?
In some ways, it's exactly right. I mean, the questions are going to him because there's a belief among some of the critics of the administration that because of the tight connections between Blackwater and the GOP and various levels of the administration, Blackwater is getting some kind of special treatment. And if you read the emails that underpin some of the report that the Oversight Committee released yesterday, you do get this impression that the State Department people in Baghdad were very concerned about essentially protecting Blackwater from any backlash, because they felt that eventually the Iraqi government could try to basically kick the company out of Iraq, which is kind of what happened recently.
What else jumped at you out of today's hearing so far?
Well, the company and Prince himself is essentially standing there, or sitting there, before the members of the House Committee, and he's not giving any ground. He's not particularly, he has a smile on his face. He's very at ease. And usually, when you have you face a firing line of members of Congress like that, people get flustered and people get a little bit more apologetic. And he doesn't seem to be that way.
Well, but he also seems to be continually saying that whatever work he's doing there is directed and overseen by the government.
That's right. He claims that because of the contracts that he has, he has certain rules of engagement that are directed, that are essentially established by the government, and he's following the rules. And one of the things that he keeps reminding people is that his force over in Baghdad and over in Iraq has not had any member of the diplomatic corps that they're protecting killed. And while they have lost, the Blackwater itself has lost members of its force, none of the people it is protecting have been lost. And that is a very important thing he's trying to get them to remember.
He also did say, though, that Blackwater believes that more can and should be done to increase accountability, oversight, and transparency. And he said that his company supports legislation written by North Carolina Democratic Rep. David Price. And that legislation is in a bill that's being considered by the House this week. And he says he does back more oversight.
That's right. He's now saying that, and it doesn't appear that the company has ever fought against it. And he's right, essentially, that these are the rules that the State Department and other branches of government have given them, and they're just simply following them.
What did Eric Prince say about the amount of times that his security guards use their weapons, fire their weapons, in Iraq? The congressional report yesterday said that 80% of the time that they were fired without provocation.
Well, his response to that is simply that the numbers seem pretty high, but not when you put it in context of the fact that the company that their force is operating in a theater of war. And that it has, hundreds of thousands of movements every day, and so the number that they cited in the report does seem high. But he's saying not when you put it in the context of the environment that they're operating in.
Evan Perez of the Wall Street Journal on today's congressional hearings, examining the role of Blackwater USA, the private contractor, in Iraq and Afghanistan. Evan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, what are the legal issues here? As we've heard, Blackwater and the State Department are being criticized for hustling a drunken Blackwater security guard out of Iraq last Christmas Eve after he allegedly killed an Iraqi guard. Blackwater and other private military contractors have immunity from prosecution in Iraq. So was the State Department legally able to spirit the guard out of the country? Joining us on the line, Laura Dickinson, law professor at the University of Connecticut. She's writing a book about the use of private contractors on the battlefield. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And can we start with this issue of immunity? We've talked about it before here on this program. We understand that it was granted to contractors in Iraq under an order that former Coalition Provisional Authority leader Paul Bremer signed just before he left Baghdad. What exactly does it say?
Well, Coalition Provisional Order 17 says that contractors are immunized for actions that they take within the terms of their contract. So there's actually a question as to whether contractors who commit abuses would in fact be immunized for things like firing on civilians, because the argument would be that's not within the terms of the contract.
Well, for instance, there was the incident that sparked this investigation and several others. It was a September 16th shooting. Blackwater guards killed 11 Iraqi civilians. Eyewitnesses say the guards shot without provocation. Blackwater says they were defending themselves. There had been a roadside bomb, and then they said they were fired on after that. That, by the way, that investigation or that incident was not discussed at today's Oversight and Government Reform hearing because the Justice Department asked, in light of FBI investigations, that no testimony be taken on that incident today. But having said that, here we have security guards who could say that they were, you know, performing their duty by escorting someone in a convoy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on the facts of the investigation, and we don't know yet what that will reveal. But I do think there's a question about whether the immunity would apply. Now, that's not to say that prosecution in Iraq would be a good idea. That's only one potential avenue of accountability. And even if the immunity were to be, if a court were to conclude the immunity did not apply, it's not clear that the Iraqi courts would really be a good venue for this. They just simply don't have the capacity to handle a case like this.
But we should say, some Iraqi legislators want just that. I mean, we understand that after that September 16th incident, there were calls in the Iraqi parliament to do away with that immunity.
Yes, there are efforts to eliminate that immunity. There's also potentially a claim that under the new Iraqi constitution, the immunity doesn't have continuing effect. But I would say that we should be very concerned about any prosecutions in Iraq at this point, given the state of the Iraqi legal system.
Well, and so how might one prosecute any private contractors with the suspicion that they've committed a crime?
Well, there are basically three options. First, the Iraq option, which, as I mentioned, I think is not a good option. Mm-hmm. The other two would be prosecution in the civilian criminal courts of the United States. And the third would be a military prosecution.
Well, I tell you what, Laura Dickinson is law professor at the University of Connecticut. She's writing a book about the use of private contractors on the battlefield. We're going to take a break in just a few seconds, but we want to talk about a couple of cases in particular. We heard about one in which there was a plane crash in Afghanistan in which Blackwater pilots were flying in a canyon with three military personnel. There's transcripts that say that they might have been kidding around, joking, as a military official said, acting like cowboys. Is this one of the cases that might become a civil case?
Well, in addition to criminal prosecution, there's also the possibility of private tort suits that could be brought in U.S. courts. That's another option. And yes, potentially that could be brought, although there are certain obstacles to those kinds of cases as well.
Laura Dickinson, law professor at the University of Connecticut. We'll have more with her after we take a quick break. And later in the program, China's charm offense, how it's using the soft power of business and diplomacy to reshape its image. That's still ahead as well. Back in just 1 minute, here and now. We're continuing our conversation about Blackwater USA and the many other private contractors playing key roles in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform holds a hearing about Blackwater USA, and a congressional report was released late yesterday that painted a picture of Blackwater USA and other contractors as rogue mercenary outfits. Our guest is Laura Dickinson, law professor at the University of Connecticut. She's writing a book about the use of private contractors on the battlefield. And, Professor, we were talking about one particular case that was raised in today's hearings, families of service members killed in a 2004 plane crash in Afghanistan in which Blackwater pilots were flying in a canyon with three military personnel. They may be considering a civil case. Henry Waxman, the committee chair in Congress today, read flight recorder transcripts he said showed the Blackwater pilots deviated from the route. Let's listen.
On this recording, the flight crew joked with each other, saying, "You're an X-Wing fighter Star Wars man, and you're expletive right. This is fun." The captain stated, "I swear to God, They wouldn't pay me if they knew how much fun this was.
The Blackwater pilots flying too low. They were inexperienced in Afghanistan. They had no flight plan. In fact, Waxman said one military personnel aboard the craft survived the crash, but then died from the cold because no one could find him. In fact, Waxman read some words of that man's widow questioning, you know, why the more experienced military personnel weren't at the helm of that plane. Again, we don't know further than this, the facts in this case, but does it sound to you as if someone is criminally liable here?
Well, I can't really comment on that case, whether there's criminal liability, but what I can tell you about is what the criminal justice system allows. And I think, you know, a lot of people have been suggesting that we don't have enough laws on the books to handle this. Well, there are some loopholes in the laws as they currently exist, but really the problem is enforcement. The main statutory regime that we have is the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, and that allows criminal prosecution of contractors who are operating in support of a Department of Defense mission. So the question is whether security contractors, many of whom are hired by the State Department, would be covered by that. I think there's an argument that could be made in the case of extreme abuse that security contractors are operating in support of a DoD mission. So Congress is planning to close that loophole, or it's attempting to close that loophole. But even with the existing law, we do have a justice system in place. We just haven't been using it. And part of that is because we've fragmented authority for conducting these prosecutions to the U.S. Attorney's offices around the country. I think we ought to centralize prosecution within an office in the Justice Department. And we also have to make sure that Justice Department investigators are on the ground in Iraq, something that we haven't had consistently in the past.
Well, let's talk about on the ground in Iraq, because Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater USA, said something I thought interesting. He said not only were his people directed and overseen by the government, but that his company had trained 500 U.S. military. So they're actually training the military. And we understand that soldiers on the ground in Iraq have had questions as to who has control over Blackwater guards. The L.A. Times recently reported that commanders were uncertain about their legal authority over contractors. You know, for instance, can they disarm them? So what's the legality on the ground?
Well, I mean, I think what all of this shows is that we don't have good enough management in place to prevent abuse ex ante, as well as systems in place to provide for accountability after the fact. So we have the enforcement problem under the criminal justice laws that we have. On the front end, on the management side, you're right, there's a lot of confusion on the ground. That's partly because multiple different agencies have agreements with different kinds of contractors, and they're subject to different rules. We need a centralized interagency working group, preferably at the National Security Council level, to make sure that the same standards are applying to these contractors where relevant. For example, that all the contractors get the same training regarding when they are allowed to use force. And that entity should make sure that the contractors are, in fact, getting that training.
Well, and in fact, the congressional report also said there were instances where some of these guards who were supposed to just be protective security guards were actually taking part in combat alongside military, and questions about the legality of that as well. And by the way, is the military vulnerable to lawsuits here for replacing trained soldiers with paid contracts?
Well, there are a lot of immunities that would apply. So, for example, in a civil suit against U.S. military officials, there would be immunities that would apply. But I think that it's more of an open question whether those immunities would apply to the contractors themselves. That's something that's being worked out in the courts. Some cases have been thrown out, but other cases are continuing on, and that's something the courts are going to be deciding.
And Professor Dickinson, we have about a minute and a half left. I'm just wondering, do you think that private military contracting is a bad thing, or just something that should be more oversight?
Well, I think we need to have a public conversation about when we should be engaging in contracting, when we should be outsourcing functions, and when we should be keeping them within the government. That's a conversation we've never had. And, you know, I was at Princeton last year, and I had the opportunity to help organize a workshop that Princeton hosted in the Program on Law and Public Affairs. And there was a group of high-level government officials, congressional staff, contractors, and academics. And there was a surprising degree of consensus on a few points. One of them, that we really had never had this conversation and that we needed to decide whether it really is appropriate to outsource security. Mm. And
well, I'm going to have to stop you there. Professor Laura Dickinson of the University of Connecticut School of Law, but we want to have you back because you are writing a book on all of this. So I'm sure we'll talk to you again. Professor Dickinson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow, someone who says outsourcing, definitely a bad idea. Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. She says that this is all an effort to replace government with private contractors. She's tomorrow. And still ahead today, girls getting more concussions than boys in certain sports. That's after the news, here and now. Myanmar's neighbors are struggling to respond to the military government's repressive regime, and the reason is basically economic. Natural gas from Myanmar, formerly Burma, provides electricity for Thailand, and companies from India and China are part of a bidding war for natural gas fields off Myanmar's western coast. For China, the reach into Myanmar is part of its new soft power, a combination of business ventures, diplomacy, and cultural exchange that China is using to win friends and access natural resources it desperately needs. In fact, argues Joshua Kurlansky in his new book, Charm Offensive, China's soft power is reshaping the world. Joshua Kurlansky is visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment's China program. We spoke with him recently, and he said he saw China's soft power firsthand when he lived in Thailand.
Thailand was a really great example where you had a country where a long time ago China was very influential, but when China was Maoist and during the Cold War, China and Thailand had very little relationship. And in about the last 10, 15 years, by really wooing opinion leaders in China and spending money on promoting China's image, you had this dramatic transformation in China's image in Thailand, where now you had politicians in Thailand signing up to go to China, touting their relationship with China. This was only 20, 30 years ago that China was essentially an enemy there.
How did it filter down to people on the street? How are they suddenly seeing China where they might not have before?
As China becomes more popular there, trade increases. All of a sudden you have massive number of goods both going to and from China. So in northern Thailand, you have an enormous influx where people see Chinese business people coming to set up shop. And a lot of these Chinese look prosperous, so their image of China is sort of formed by that. So you definitely get it at the ground level, and definitely in Myanmar too. The Chinese presence is very, very significant. Business people, traders, and investment, almost overwhelming in the north of the country.
And how, I mean, you give the example of a taxi cab driver, for instance. Previously, taxi cab drivers, when you said you were an American, you had one reaction, and now you had another. And I'm just wondering, you know, how did you see China maybe taking advantage of a shift in opinion towards America?
It's helped China in a lot of ways. Students who can't get visas who come to the U.S., some of them will go to China. If the U.S. is viewed as kind of not thinking about human rights as much, it benefits China because it decreases the United States' ability to criticize what China is doing. If the U.S. is viewed as kind of not engaged in a lot of places other than Iraq or Afghanistan, it benefits China because it looks like China is more engaged.
Now, there's a quote from a Chinese diplomat who traveled to Africa last year, was quoted as saying, "Non-intervention is our brand. Intervention is the Americans' brand."
I do think it's very debatable whether China actually doesn't intervene. When they wanted North Korea to come to the table for the six-party talks, they cut off supply of energy to North Korea. When they want some better result in Sudan, they send a peacekeeping forces and a personal envoy there. China doesn't not intervene, but at least it's very effective PR.
Tibet certainly wouldn't view China.
Tibet, Xinjiang, as, yeah, right, a lot of places.
Yeah, as non-interventionist. But we're talking about branding. We're talking about the image that they're trying to establish. You say they've been successful. What changed? For years, the Chinese were focused on economic development at home, closed society. When and why did they decide to embark on this new campaign of projecting this new image?
After China began to open up, they spent a long time really focused on growing their own economy, their own obviously very difficult political situation. And in the last few years, you now have a generation of Chinese, particularly younger people, who grew up in eastern China, in wealthier places, who kind of think it's natural that China should sort of reassume their place on the world stage. And then you also have a leadership in China who began to interact with the world. And then what happened is, as China got more economically engaged with the world, they just started to need more of the world. They're going to be the world's biggest consumer of oil and gas probably within 20 years. They desperately need relationships with all these countries. They just have grown big enough that they can't really ignore the world anymore.
And also the 2008 Olympics loom on the horizon and have been planned for years. I mean, how much was that a part of this new PR push? Or is it, you know, is it just the other way around? You know, maybe they got the 2008 Olympics because of the PR push.
The 2008 Olympics are definitely designed to be kind of the capstone of China's emergence as a major world power, to be kind of a coming out party. And you can see that in the way that they've spent so much money, probably over $140 billion, on projects and new buildings in Beijing that don't necessarily exist just for sport. They're a way to boost prestige. So to get the Olympics, they had to engage in kind of more positive PR to suggest that their human rights record was going to improve, which I'm not sure that it has, but in any event, it helped them get the Olympics.
You know, we just had a guest on the program who was in jail for 5 years. He would say no. But their efforts to at least convey a more benign image seem to be paying off. I mean, the Olympics. But you also cite studies showing that nearly every country in Africa has a more favorable view of China than the U.S. That could be because of the U.S.'s intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan. But is it also because of China's efforts? What are your stats?
China's become a huge purchaser of commodities in Africa. They're basically helping save a number of African economies in the short run. In the long term, there are a lot of other concerns.
Let's just stay with Darfur for a moment, because obviously there was a huge move to get China to divest of its investments in Sudan because of Darfur, to get it to be more politically active. It's learning, you know, what it's like to be a country with money to spend.
On Darfur, I mean, the positive view would be that China has supported peacekeeping there, appointed its own special envoy, and seems engaged. The negative view would be people would say that that's just window dressing and it won't change the fundamental policy. I do think that the Chinese government has been very shocked by how quickly and strongly activist groups have been able to get support in the West for their Darfur campaign and link it to the Olympics. And so the Chinese government, I think, is on its back foot about that.
And look at some of the stats, though. 800 companies in Africa, $1.6 billion a year in investment. Is China helped in Africa by the fact that it has a little history there? It's got none of the baggage that maybe some of the European colonists or the U.S. with the Cold War have.
They're helped by it in Africa, and they're hurt by it in Asia, where they have centuries of history not always good with China. So like Vietnam, for example, we in the United States think about the Vietnam War, but actually after the Vietnam War, Vietnam fought another war with China, which few people in the U.S. even know about.
I just have to jump in and say that, you know, the program, we have a friend from Vietnam, an interpreter, who has said to me that the U.S.-American war is viewed by the Vietnamese as sort of a little flea prior to the huge conflict with China.
In Africa, China benefits from kind of being a new kid with not that much history. In Asia, they don't benefit.
Where do you think this is all headed, Joshua? Because you also write about how China has become the second largest source of peacekeeping troops after France, among the five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, that in fact it's looked to embrace U.N. activities that the U.S. might be critical of, again, to try to present itself as the new moderate world power. Where do you think it's heading?
China is going to have to think about whether it is going to take on all these responsibilities and kind of public things to do that the U.S. and the Britain before have done. Or are they going to kind of remain this country that provides some aspects of a big power, but when it comes down to it, kind of is reluctant to actually sort of step fully into those boots. But I mean, at this point, they're kind of headed in this direction. It's actually, I think, moving faster than people think.
Joshua Kurlansik, special correspondent for The New Republic, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment's China program. His latest book is Charm Offensive: How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World. Joshua, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Thank you so much.
Quick reminder, you can listen to the show stream live at our website, here-now.org, at any time, and you can download a podcast there as well. Before we go today, Louis Black, just reading the paper makes him crazy, as you'll hear. You're listening to Here and Now. Concussions from playing sports. We used to think it was just a guy thing. It happened on the football field where the goal is to hit hard and often. Well, football does cause the most concussions by far. But according to a new study from Ohio State University and Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, when it comes to basketball and soccer, girls get more concussions than boys. In soccer, 68% more. In basketball, the rate for concussions in girls is three times the boys. Dr. Robert Cantu is a neurosurgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, one of the nation's leading experts in concussion management. He joins us. Dr. Cantu, are you seeing this in your office?
Yes, Robin, we are. And actually, these statistics are not surprising, that in the same sports that are played by women and men, for instance, soccer and basketball, that women have a higher incidence of concussion than men in the same sport.
Well, we're reading about this in the New York Times today, and a lot of girls are saying, see, now you finally know that we play hard. But why else would they have more concussions than boys?
Well, I don't think we honestly know the answers with absolute certainty, Robin. Some of the theories include that their neck development may not be quite as well developed as men, so the shock absorber for the brain, namely the neck, is not as well developed. One of the other leading theories, though, is that perhaps women are a little bit more honest in reporting their concussion than are men, although, quite frankly, women, just like men, are playing through a lot of injuries and not always owning up to them.
We understand that, you know, heading the ball in soccer isn't the cause of these concussions. But, however, when two heads go for the same ball and they collide, there can be a concussion. And there's these headbands now that young girls are wearing. Does that have a protective effect?
Robin, there's no hard proof that the headbands do have a significant protective effect against concussion. And unfortunately, some women who wear them think that they are being protected and perhaps play more aggressively to their detriment.
The study also says that girls took longer than boys for their symptoms to resolve and be able to return to their sport. Why might that be?
Well, again, we don't really know the answers to that. One of the obvious other theories that's there is the hormonal difference between men and women, especially the estrogen levels and the cyclical nature of them. And whether that is ultimately going to be proven to be a factor or not, we really don't know with certainty today.
First of all, we should remind people, what are the symptoms of a concussion?
Well, there are more than 25 symptoms that go with a concussion, but the most common ones include headache, seeing stars, being disoriented, having recent memory issues, concentration issues, attention span issues, ringing in your ears, difficulty with sensitivity to light, sensitivity to noise, difficulty falling asleep. There are 25 different symptoms that any neurologist or neurosurgeon or primary care physician or, for that matter, certified athletic trainer that's following an individual with a concussion needs to look for.
We understand from past reporting that sometimes the second concussion after a first, if the first is untreated, can be devastating and that these symptoms can be delayed.
Yes, that's very true, Robin. What we worry about most are concussions that occur before an individual is healed from a prior concussion or one that comes very closely on a previous one. So just like all concussions are not the same, some can be mild, some can be severe. When you start to get them close together, that's much more worrisome than if they're spaced out a year or more apart.
How bad have you seen this get? I mean, because some people still hearing about concussion, they think, well, a headache for a while, but then you're back on your feet. Have you seen, you know, young girls especially just completely knocked out of the game?
Yes, Robin. We've had a number of youngsters that we've seen in the last year who quite frankly had their ability to function in school altered a great deal. We have one high school student who is unable to go on to Stanford University where he had a full scholarship because of post-concussion symptoms. Hopefully we'll be able to in the future. So we've had individuals that not only lost significant amounts of time from school, but couldn't even go on in school.
Dr. Robert Cantu, a neurosurgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, reacting to a new study from Ohio State University, saying that girls have more concussions than boys when it comes to basketball and soccer. Dr. Cantu, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Okay, after a quick break, what makes The Daily Show's Lewis Black so darn mad? Oh, where do we start? That's in just 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now.
Dick Cheney. And that's all I got to say. Isn't it great that we've reached that point?
Louis Black has been called comedy's reigning left-leaning rageaholic. He paces the stage in a silk suit, pinky ring, and rimmed glasses, looking a little like a lecturer or a television executive, actually looking a lot like Al Franken. And then, boom.
If I've learned anything from the last year and a half, it's quite simply that we don't know what we're doing anymore.
His eyes bulge. He swears a blue streak on Comedy Central's The Daily Show and HBO comedy specials. He rants about politics, customer service reps, and general idiocy, prompting one writer to call Louis Black man on the verge of an aneurysm. His Grammy and Emmy Award-nominated Red, White, and Screwed HBO comedy special is now out on DVD. He sold out shows at Carnegie Hall and L.A.'s Walt Disney Theater this year and is on his way to the Boston Comedy Festival this weekend and joins us now on the phone. Welcome.
We don't even need to talk now.
I know. Goodbye.
That's perfect, except that I don't look like I'm better looking than Al. I'm the attractive Al.
Well, and you know, when we hear that you're coming to where we are in Boston, I just picture people, you know, rolling down those covers that go over storefronts and things, you know, like a storm's blowing in. What are you angry about now?
Well, where do you start? Terrorism, and then the Chinese are going to kill us. They basically have turned Toys R Us into an Al-Qaeda camp. It's constant. It is just a constant barrage that I can't keep up with.
You said that, you know, the last few years have been difficult because there is too much. And I think in your act you say, why don't I just read the newspaper? How much of that, though, suits you? I mean, would you have this anger anyway? And thank goodness you have man's folly to, you know, to aim it at.
Yeah, I would have this anger. It's turned more political, but I really prefer to be more of a social commentator than a broad political things. I've got to get over the fact, because, I mean, it was always, going back to the question, it was always something. I mean, I had 45 minutes about weather alone at one point.
Just weather. Yeah.
And weathermen. What kind of a job is that? I mean, I started out with just talking about the weather guy in San Diego, which is the greatest job on earth. It's going to be nice. Exhausting.
Well, speaking of the weather, you rail against the government response to Katrina, that former FEMA chief Michael Brown ran horse shows before his political appointment. Do you ever worry that it's, you know, sort of like fish in a barrel? It's too easy.
Well, that's what it's become. I mean, why, what do you need me for? I mean, the front page of the paper, it's like, you know, it's reality has overtaken my gig.
Speaking of which, in your act, you pull out a worn scrap of newspaper and you read it. It's a report about President Bush's visit to the Brooke Army Medical Center to talk to amputees. Bush relates to them that he also has an injury. He sustained it while removing a tree. In this cut, you begin with his words to them.
I didn't have it here at the hospital, but in combat with a cedar. That's a tree. He was fighting a tree. I eventually won. Our president beat the tree. The cedar gave me a little scratch. He is talking to members of the armed forces who have lost limbs about his little scratch. It's my firm belief that if you are the president, you absolutely have to know where you are in the time-space continuum.
You know, I mean, obviously that clip meant, that piece of newspaper meant something to you.
You have to have it in front of you at times, because otherwise nobody believes it. Then the other is, well, you're taking it out of context. That's my favorite. Well, I go, okay, well, great. What context would you like me to put it in? What would you put before he said that or after he said that that would make it any better? I mean, I'm not a big impeach person, but that's where he's not in touch with reality.
And I want to rush to say that you're somewhat bipartisan in your attacks. You haven't wanted to talk about politics exclusively, but, of course, that's what's in the news. But it sounds as if you could spread the anger around. Am I reaching? Are you secretly, you know, running someone's Democratic campaign?
Oh, God. No, I'm really, the act at this point has reached the point of, if you're a Democrat, if you're still a Democrat or a Republican, the line I use is you're living in a delusion that even when I was hallucinating on acid, I never got to. to hear the excitement of the people. Oh, look, the Democrats have taken over Congress. Oh, this will really change things. A party that for the last 6 years did nothing, nothing at all, and I'm supposed to get excited about them. And now they're parading around the country? What are they saying? We're going to give you a bigger and better nothing?
How did you Democrats find Kerry? What is the matter with you people? Did you not listen to him talk? The first time I heard him speak, after two paragraphs, I said, "F**k, I don't have enough breadcrumbs to get home."
Well, we're hearing a little of the anger, and a lot of people would say, you know, why ask why? Because there's so much to talk about. But you, you know, have been upset also at the phone company, Starbucks. I mean, the list is long, and you said, you know, you'd always be angry. What is that about? I mean, it's putting aside whatever is in the headlines right now that's outraging a lot of people, but what's the, I mean, your parents were are on the DVD, they were in the audience at your show, they look perfectly nice. You know, where does it come from?
The basis of the anger, which is why I feel it's always been bipartisan, has to do with authority. People in charge really need to be competent. You know, the first inkling I had of it was when they sent me under a desk to hide from a nuclear bomb. I said, these adults don't know what they're talking about. Don't show me pictures of a nuclear bomb if you're going to send me under the desk and think that I'm being protected by being under the desk.
You knew that as a kid? You knew you wouldn't be protected?
Oh, absolutely. It's kindling. After the bomb drops, why don't we run to the playground so I can melt properly? They're nuts.
See, I bought it.
No, I had really was. That was the beginning of the end for me. And now, as an adult, I find myself in my act more and more apologizing for things to the kids who are in the audience, because I have a fair amount of them, for what the adults in the community are doing. I mean, it's unbelievable to finally be in charge and be so pathetic at it. And we are. It's disgusting.
Well, Louis Black, what makes you happy? I mean, is there anything?
Oh, puppy's fur. What makes me happy?
Do you wear it? Puppy's fur.
No. What makes me happy is, dinner with friends, and I play golf. And that's kind of really sad.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just can't imagine going on the golf course with you, in case it doesn't go well.
Oh, no, it's kind of horrifying. But it's something that allows me to get outside my head, and it's so inane. It's such an inane game.
Well, we hope you get in a few rounds before you get here to Boston.
I'm thrilled with coming back to Boston, and that makes me happy.
Louis Black's Red, White, and Screwed and Rules of Enragement are now available on DVD. For more on Louis's tour or the Boston Comedy Festival, where, again, he'll appear this weekend, go to our website, here-now.org. Louis, thank you so much.
You have made my day.
Now, we are never going to attack the North Koreans, because they are the most evil people on the planet. And how do we know that? Because when we get video and film footage from North Korea, it's always in black and white. It's not the film. These people are so evil, they have no color.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.